probably thought it was my lunch. This is a speaker's ephemeral insurance clock. Mr. Dobson bought this for me because that 50 years ago he heard me speak at Big Sandy. I didn't think I needed it until my wife told me that Little Falls Church started calling me Bruce Waterhouse. So any of you speakers want to buy one of these, let's see. There is a name on here, but everybody, us geezers all carry one of these. This is a handy dandy magnifying glass. There we go. It's got the name of the company Mr. Dobson got it from. I see it right here. It says Howard Baker Corporation. If he won't sell them to you, I'll rent it to you for one thin tithe. You know, Mr. Dobson and I go way back. You heard that? Way, way back. I think this is probably the first feast I think we've shared together since that time. And I know he's been, well, admitting to a few mistakes. But you got to admit, there's little bitty ones. You know, they really aren't very big. Shucks, I just found out I'm supposed to be in Jekyll Island. See you, Joe. Anyway, it's great to be here. It's a beautiful part of the country. We were here 20 years ago, and it's changed a little bit. And went to the Haygoods last night. Boy, is that a show. For those that haven't been there, it's some get little kids been here 24 years, grew up. I guess used to perform in Silver Dollar City, but quite a show. So anyway, good to be here. I've got to ask a question. How many here have ever heard of Garrison Keillor and Prairie Home Companion? I've got a couple of you out there. You see, my wife is from Lake Wobegon. And this is true. She's from Holding Ford, Minnesota, and you go there, there's a granite statue that says start of the trail, Lake Wobegon, and just a couple little towns around there. One of them, called Freeport, has a little restaurant called Charlie's, and that's the Chatterbox Cafe. And we've been over there to eat a few times, and they point out where Garrison used to sit and take his notes. Well, anyway, I heard the other day that Pastor Knutson of the Norwegian Lutheran church there had a problem with the church roof. It was shot. So he decided to have a special offering to pay for a new one and to sweeten the pot. He said the largest donation would get to pick three hymns next service. So the offering was taken, and blow and behold, $1,000 bill showed up. Well, Pastor Knutson was floored. That happens when your roof's shot. He asked the congregation who was so generous. A little lady, elderly lady in the back pew raised her hand, Mrs. Janssen. Up in Minnesota, we got a lot of them Janssens, you know. He asked her to come up in front of the congregation, so she came up, and he thanked her profusely and said, now you get to pick out your three favorite hymns. And this great big smile went over her face, and she looked out over the congregation. She said, I'll take him, him, and him. And that's the news from Lake Wobegon, where all the women get to pick their hymns. And the pastors tell bad jokes. And all the kids can't wait to get out of church. Anyway, I think there's supposed to be a sermon in here somewhere. I take requests. Yeah, I've got one here somewhere. Let me see. Yeah, I was down hiding there under a piece of lutefisk. Those that aren't from Scandinavian background, that's one of life's finest delicacies. Take a perfectly good piece of walleye and just ruin it with lye, and then you eat it. And somebody calls it food. I guess that's how the Vikings got over here. Oh, Lord. All right. Well, I have to say, all seriousness aside, Mr. Cagle's fine sermonette really, as you'll see, led nicely into my message. I got a little one, too. All right. Besides, my wife's got a hook. As we look back through time and the broad sweep of history, and forward over 1,000 years from now, we're left with one inescapable conclusion. A perfect government, a perfect environment, and perfect leadership do not always guarantee a perfect outcome or result. It's kind of startling to contemplate, but it's true. History, both past and future, provide us with three startling examples of this mind-bending phenomena. Every time I think about it, it's still hard to grasp. Lucifer and his demonic third, the Garden of Eden, the snake episode, and Gog and Magog 2, the Four Corners Gang of Revelation 20, verse 8. Now, what does this almost surreal trio of events have to say about the 1,000 years of perfect environment, perfect government, with perfect leadership pictured by this wonderful festival that we keep every year? Does this scenario somehow challenge the thought that those who live over into this magnificent period, from the heart-rending ravages of Armageddon, as well those who were born and grow up and are converted during the 1,000-year reign, they somehow get off light in their spiritual growing up process? It does appear that all it takes is for Satan to step back onto the earthly scene for a brief, you know, cameo appearance, as we see in Revelation 20, and he's able to deeply influence and deceive a sizable portion of the millennium's last generation or two. And what about the parents and the grandparents that are physically alive or even changed spirit beings? You start to cogitate on that a little bit and you say, how could that happen? As they watch the unthinkable unfold before their eyes. There's much to ponder here today in this surreal scenario as we think and deeply consider our preparation as kings and priests for our assignment in eternity. Today, let's step into that paradise for a while. It's a time of lions and lambs, blooming deserts, and all things utopian. It's a wonderful time. Why, it's an age when 70-year-old guys like me will be able to program our DVRs. When TV commercials will not, and I repeat, will not, exceed their programs in time and in volume. Won't that be wonderful? And ah, yes, that great Scandahoovian entertainment team, Sven and Ole, we'll join Rodney Dangerfield in finally getting some respect. Yeah, sure, you betcha. Now we're talking paradise here, real paradise. Everybody gets along. No relationship problems. Why, even the animals like each other. Life will be a proverbial breeze with very few of the bumps and lumps of life that we experience, right? Well, almost. It's going to be wonderful. It's going to be a joyous time, no doubt about it. We hear about it every year. It's the highlight of the year, God's great family reunion. The scriptures are replete with magical prophetic pictures of this time that we celebrate. We love it. We so look forward to it. But totally lump and bump free, which is how we sometimes tend to visualize millennial paradise. What will this great spiritual adjustment period, and that's what it's going to be for a while, what is it going to be like for us? For the great remnant of mankind, as Mr. Cagle pointed out, are still in global shock from World War III, the really big one, Armageddon. As spirit beings, we'll have quite a different perspective, one not shared by the rest of the mankind, at least for a while. One of the first glimpses we get of this day's fulfillment on the other side of C2C, we're in the day of acronyms, everybody uses acronyms, C2C, that stands for Christ's Second Coming. In Zechariah 14, it was mentioned first day by Mr. Jones, I believe. Turn over to Zechariah 14 just for a moment. I'll hit it from a slightly different vantage point. This is the initial transition post-Armageddon. Pick it up here. Verse 1, it says, "A day of the Lord," and I'm reading from the New International Version. "A day of the Lord is coming when your plunder will be divided among you. And I will gather all the nations to Jerusalem to fight against it," as we heard. "The city will be captured, the houses ransacked, and the women raped. And half of the city will go into exile, but the rest of the people will not be taken from the city. And then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. And on that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives east of Jerusalem. And the Mount of Olives will split in two from east to west and forming a great valley with half the mountain moving north and half moving south." Over to verse 8. "And on that day living water will flow out from Jerusalem, half to the eastern sea and half to the western sea." That would be the Mediterranean and the Dead Sea. "In the summer and the winter, and the Lord will be king over the whole earth. And on that day there will be one Lord in his name, the only name." Let's go on a little further, as we picked up and heard earlier. Verse 16, just to reiterate. "Then the survivors from all the nations that have attacked Jerusalem will go up year after year to worship the King, the Lord Almighty, and to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. And if any of the peoples of the earth do not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord Almighty, they will have no rain. And if the Egyptian people do not go up and take part, they will have no rain. And the Lord will bring them the plague he inflicts on the nations that do not go up to celebrate this wonderful festival. This will be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all nations that do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles." Now here we find the classic transition scriptures at the beginning of the millennium that we've heard read to us probably at almost every feast we've ever attended. You might say, as we heard earlier, another fine message, this is the conclusion to observing the birth and toddler years of the millennium and the kingdom of God through the eyes of Zechariah and some of the other millennial prophets. You know, this will coming up in my 50th year in the church. And the more I'm around, the more I see. I've been in the ministry about 45 of those. You start to realize spiritual child rearing is messy at times. Real messy. Even for the best parents in the universe. It gives us some hope. It takes time. In this case, as we read, maybe a lot of it, more than we kind of tend to think. We'll see a little more of that in a minute. As the kingdom of God is set up, and the gospel of God's wise and beneficent government gradually flows out, kind of like that river, a refreshing, life-giving river to a shocked and decimated world. And you can't even begin to comprehend the numbers. You take all the battles ever fought in the history of man, recorded mankind, about 3,500 years, and you put them in to an addition bag, and you maybe have somewhere 100, 150, maybe 200 million people, maybe 300. As was pointed out, at minimum, one half of the world's population will be decimated. That's close to 4 billion. It might be as high as 90%. You can't comprehend those numbers. I mean, World War II, WW2, the big one, was bad enough. And we often think, certainly, of the tremendous. I've been to Yad Vashem and seen the Holocaust Museum in Israel. We think about the 6 million Jews and the final solution and the trying to eliminate a whole people. Little did they realize Stalin got rid of 50 million. Mao Zedong and company. Almost as many, and on it goes. It's an incredible number. So the world will be in shock. How long before the planet begins to look like the utopian descriptions of the classic millennial scriptures of Isaiah 2 and 11? How long is that going to take? Well, let's see if God's time machine pilots can give us some clues. Let's fly into the future alongside Ezekiel. Turn over to Ezekiel 38. A very interesting chapter. Many respects. Got to dig a little bit. Mr. Tom Robinson and company did a fine job with our, we call it the BURP, Bible Reading Program. I think it's really our commentary, and I think, look at it that way, it's beautifully done. Let's pick up verses 10 through 12 here, chapter 38. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. On that day, thoughts will come into your mind, and you will devise an evil scheme. And you will say, I will invade a land of unwalled villages, and I will attack a peaceful, unsuspecting people, and all of them living without walls and without gates and bars. And I will plunder and loot and turn my hand against the resettled ruins and the people gathered from the nations, rich in livestock and goods and living at the center of the land. Now, as you read that carefully, you ask yourself, when was the last time that Israel lived in unwalled cities, at safety and at peace? Not in this age, not since 1948 and its rebirth. And even going back, you can look at the Old Testament. Never happened. So we know this is future. They make the case, we look at the beginning of the millennium, and it looks like here's Israel resettled as a showcase nation around Jerusalem. And starting to show that wonderful way of life that we picture here as a foretaste. And yet here we see Ezekiel in that time machine, and we see that it goes out concentrically in waves from Jerusalem. And it's going to take a few years to go the 2,000, maybe 3,000 miles up into these far reaches. 5,000, 10,000 in some cases. So what does all this have to say about our job in the millennium? Specifically. And about spiritual child rearing in general. One last look onto 1,000 years of spiritually formative geopolitical activity, culminating at the end with one last surreal satanic appearance, inciting one final worldwide rebellion to end all rebellions. It's interesting to contemplate. In a perfect environment, with a perfect government, and perfect leadership. Why is this? How could it be? How could this happen? Let's start our search for understanding with the prophet who wrote more about this time period. He's known as the millennial prophet, Isaiah. Let's turn over to chapter 30, verse 19. We get into the millennial theme here as you read in 2, verse 19. He says, O people of Zion who live in Jerusalem, you will weep no more. How gracious he will be when you cry for help. And as soon as he hears, he will answer you. And although the Lord gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, your teachers will be hidden no more. With your own eyes you will see them. And whether you turn to the right or to the left, your ears will hear a voice behind you saying, This is the way, walk you in it. Verse 19, if. Some interesting scriptures here in the midst of paradise and utopia. This is not time dependent. This could take place any place, any time during the 1,000 years. And it says, if you ask. Verse 20, though the Lord gives adversity and affliction, or as the New Living Translation has, suffering. How could that be? In the millennium, right in the middle of the millennium prophet. Chapter 30. With all kinds of descriptions all around. Adversity, affliction, suffering. Notice the strong personal responsibility factor implied here. In the millennial spiritual child-rearing approach by God. Ask. And this is the way, walk you in it. Doesn't appear to be spiritual arm twisting, but a strong teaching emphasis. As we've said for years, going back, remember the years Mr. Armstrong and certainly Mr. Waterhouse used to preach about it. However, there are consequences. Ultimately, and especially, to get the nations into the program. Remember what we saw in Zechariah 14? Isaiah 30 maybe addresses more of the personal program after national acceptance. It appears anyway. And we know that God can work with anybody, anywhere, anytime, if they are ready. They have to be ready. As you heard about the parables. So if we really delve into these millennium scriptures and try to picture and understand what that fabulous time will really be like and what our job responsibilities will entail, we must conclude there are going to be some challenges. There are going to be some challenges right at the beginning during the transition, according to Isaiah, along the way. It doesn't sound like anybody's going to be walking on that straight and narrow path for a whole 1,000 years, all hundreds of millions to billions. I would imagine after the earth gets set up, we're going to probably have a population far in excess of the 7.4 billion we've got today. Probably get up closer to, 10, 15 billion. Who knows? That's a lot of folks. By the way, you like titles? That's the title of my sermon, The Millennial Challenge. So there are going to be some lumps along the way, and not just during the post Armageddon transition of Zechariah 14, Ezekiel 38, but throughout the 1,000 years, right up to the Great White Throne Judgment period and during it as well, because the Great White Throne Judgment period is just an extension of the millennium. You might say the millennium is Eden 2, White Throne Judgments, Eden 2.5, 2.5 or whatever. Let's learn a little about what I call spiritual lumpology. In preparation for our vital responsibilities, from a man who had a PhD in it. His name was Sigmund Volman. I'd like to quote from a Reader's Digest article titled Sigmund Volman's Reality Test by Robert Fulgham. You probably heard that name. He wrote, All I Know I Learned in Kindergarten. So I'm going to read a little bit of this, kind of set things up. We'll head down, get into the backstretch. It was the summer of 1959. At a resort inn in the Sierra Nevadas of Northern California, I had a job that combined being the night desk clerk in the lodge and helping with the horse wrangling in the stables. The owner-manager was Swiss, with European notions about conditions of employment. He and I did not get along. I thought he was a fascist who wanted pleasant or peasant employees who knew their place. And I was 22, just out of college, and pretty free with my opinions. One week, the employees had been served the same thing for lunch every day. Two wieners and a mound of sauerkraut and stale rolls. To compound insult with injury, the cost of the meals were deducted from our paychecks. I was outraged. On Friday night of that awful week, I was at my desk job around 11 p.m., and the night auditor had just come on duty. I went into the kitchen and saw a note to the chef to the effect that Venus and sauerkraut were on the menu for two more days. That tore it. For the lack of a better audience, I unloaded on the night auditor, Sig Woolman. I declared that I'd had it up to here, and I was going to get a plate of wieners and sauerkraut and wake up the owner and throw it at him, and nobody was going to make me eat wieners anymore, especially for a whole week, and make me pay for it on top. It was un-American, and I didn't like wieners and sauerkraut enough to eat one day. And the whole hotel stunk, and I was packing my bags and heading for Montana, where they never heard of wieners and sauerkraut and wouldn't feed that stuff to pigs. Something like that. I raved on this way for 20 minutes. My monologue was delivered at the top of my lungs, punctuated by blows on the front desk with a fly swatter, the kicking of chairs, and much profanity. As I pitched my fit, Sig Woolman sat quietly on his stool, watching me with sorrowful eyes. Put a bloodhound in a suit, and you have Sig Woolman. He had good reason to look sorrowful. Survivor of Auschwitz, 3 years. German Jew. Thin, coughed a lot. He liked being alone at the night job. It gave him intellectual space and peace and quiet. And even more, he could go into the kitchen and have a snack whenever he wanted to. All the wieners and sauerkraut he wished. To him, it was a feast. More than that, there was nobody around to tell him what to do. In Auschwitz, he dreamed of such a time. And the only person he saw at work was me, the night disturber of his dream. Our shifts overlapped 1 hour, and here I was, a one-man war party at full cry. Listen, Fulsham, listen me. You know what's wrong with you? It's not Venus and Kraut. It's not the boss. It's not the chef. It's not this job. So what's wrong with me? Fulsham, you think you know everything, but you don't know the difference between inconvenience and the problem. If you break your neck, if you have nothing to eat, if your house is on fire, then you got a problem. Everything else is inconvenience. Life is inconvenient. Life is lumpy. I think we'd have to agree Mr. Woolman had seen a few big lumps in his life. You maybe know somebody that came out of some of the biggest lumps in history. Pick your war, pick your battle. Most people, I feel, instinctively and intuitively know the difference between lumps and even have some inkling on how to deal with them. And yet, which of us isn't or hasn't been caught off guard, challenged emotionally and mentally in this area? I mean, we all are. Phyllis and I, on the way down from Minnesota. No snow up there yet, but it's coming. We got lost in Kansas City. We were going to stay overnight in the south end and took a couple wrong turns. Thanks, Joe. Good directions. Our fault, totally. Didn't warn him we were coming. I wanted him to sleep. But it's easy to get caught up. It's tough to keep it all in perspective during the day-to-day grind of spiritual boot camp we call life. This is our break, our little sanctuary. We get every year and then once, one day a week, the beautiful Sabbath. It's our weekly sanctuary. Let's visit a few of the problems on the lumpy side of life. Those that had to deal with them from Isaiah 30 and a preparation for providers of spiritual lump aid when this time is fulfilled. Let's start with Luke's outlook. Turn over to Luke chapter 13. Luke 13, verses 1 through 5. Now there were some present at the time who told Jesus about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. And Jesus answered, "Do you think these Galileans were the worse sinners than all the other Galileans because he suffered this way? And I tell you no, but unless you repent, you too will all perish. Or those 18 who died when the Tower of Siloam fell on them, do you think they were more guilty than all those others living in Jerusalem? I tell you no, but unless you repent, you too shall perish." It's kind of just a short spiritual footnote of history, only mentioned as an example in another context, that of repentance. But let's go back to that horrible day in the lives of many families, possibly as many as 18 or 18 people, could be 18 individuals, 18 different families. The incident is mentioned with few details, but it conjures up many. 18 people, maybe on an evening stroll, perhaps discussing politics. I've been there. I've been on a beautiful Jerusalem evening. The evenings are dry and cool. The stars and the moon are out. We walked around that beautiful place with so much history when I was on the dig back in 1970, between the wars, Yom Kippur and the Sixth Day. It could have been people strolling like that, so I was kind of there. I could kind of relate to that. Maybe they were having a political discussion. Nobody around here these days is having a political discussion, right? That's all that's on the news. That maybe was innocent enough. Might have gone something like this. Who's going to be on here? Who's going to be Herod's new running mate? Should be a Jew. Herod's an Idumean. Edomite from Esau and Arab from his mother's side. Yes, a Jew from the south of Judea would balance the old fox's ticket. Now we know they didn't have Democratic Republic or anything during those days. But you know, you get the idea. It could have been a political discussion, something like that, probably talking about, or it could have been something else. We don't know. The Tower of Siloam could have been a fortification on the outer wall near the Pool of Siloam. Thus the relationship and the name. Possibly an aqueduct built by Pilate, some surmise, little's known. But this we know. 18 families were sent into shock that fateful day. It's kind of like the Mira building in Oklahoma City, not far from Mr. Dobson's hometown. I've been down and seen it. Or maybe the Twin Towers of 9/11. Let's put this into perspective for that city and country. Jerusalem and Judea in Christ's day, the country may have been about the same size as it is today, maybe a little smaller. Today it's about 7 to 8 million people. Probably less back then, but not significantly less. USA Today is about 325 to 30 million people. Approximately 50 times the size of Judea at Christ's era. Comparative, that would be an approximately 1,000 people dying today, relatively speaking, to its size. Or four times the Mira building in a city, Jerusalem, one-tenth the size of Oklahoma City. Or compare it to 9/11's numbers, it's about a third of the mother of all U.S. tragedies. The point is, to dozens, maybe hundreds of relatives, think about it. If it were 18 families, in those days families were a little larger. Extended out, how many people knew about this? Seemingly, you know, time and chance type of incident. Well, it was a big lump for a lot of families, a lot of friends and relatives. A totally unexpected lump. Husbands, wives, children, friends, colleagues. We don't know the mix, but everybody wanted to know why. Secret sins? Great wretchedness of life? Christ says not so. He implies they were ordinary citizens like you and me. No better, no worse than the rest of Jerusalem, Oklahoma City, or New York. Could this happen in the millennium? You probably never thought of this. Just ask the innocent women, children, and families of the leaders and armies of millennial Gog and Magog, not once but twice, at the beginning and at the end. Women and children of stubborn men and leaders putting their families through drought, famine, and plagues, potentially. It implies it's probably going to happen for a while. And it's definitely going to happen at the end when they're dissolved before grandpa and grandma's eyes, that last generation. These loved ones will be in shock as reports come back from the millennial battlefields around Jerusalem. Maybe not the time and chance circumstances of the Tower of Siloam or the terrorist work of Mura, 9/11, but big millennial problems. Not inconveniences for surviving families, that's for sure. It's probably going to happen. Some of it for sure. I don't know how far Isaiah's 30s, and that's at the beginning and the end. I don't know how far his twin spiritual challenges, bread of affliction, water of adversity, will take us after the big transition. But there'll be some things going on. Much to ponder, Noel Sigmund's reality test in the years ahead. Let's get a little more up close and personal, as they say these days, in our next look back, look ahead. Come to John 9. John 9, verses 1 through 3. As he went along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned?" Seems to be the first, that seems to be the default reaction of the disciples. Who sinned? And many times it probably was. But the two incidents, or three incidents, we've just recorded, you've got to throw in Pilate's work with the Galatians. His disciples asked him, "Okay, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Christ said, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned," said Jesus, "but this happened so the work of God might be displayed in his life." I submit that's pretty tough duty. Part of this very messy child-rearing business that we've been allowed and privileged to be a part of, You think that one through. A lot of different directions and what God is allowing. And then ask yourself, how's he going to clean this whole thing up and gather in his family for the rest of eternity? A lot of questions. And we're going to be right in the middle of it, helping him. Now, this one seems to have a happier ending. We see over in verse 7. And he tells him to go wash, and he's healed. Being born blind and surviving to adulthood in a far less handicap-friendly, I think I can put it that way, society than, say, modern Israel today, with our extensive social legislation, our many watchdog organizations, it's a great safety net out there. And looking out for us. So in that day, it had to be a big lump. We've seen pictures. We watched a few Christian movies over the years. They'll show men there was a lot of beggars going on. Christ talks about beggars, people on the street. It was a tough slog. This man was born blind. He had to have the cup and pencil program going pretty early age. Will God allow such happenstance to occur in his kingdom to and for his glory? What about Zechariah 14:17 again? The children of parents, again, who choose not to go up to Jerusalem at first or even later. Some of them are going to pay a thirsty and maybe a hungry price for their parents' spiritual stubbornness during those ensuing droughts, possibly. Some pretty big lumps for some awfully thirsty kids. We're going to need a lot of sensitive, spiritually sophisticated lump aid in those days. And for the other utopian challenges that are sure to arise in the messy business called spiritual child rearing. It's a lot of what we're doing. Getting ready for those times. Let's look into the other side of Sig's reality test. We'll check with Luke again. Defined this time an oatmeal variety lump. Turn over to Luke 10, just a little ahead where we were. I'm not going to read this one. It was read earlier, Mr. Pirowitz. I'll just mention a couple things. You know the story of Mary and Martha. Here we find Martha's lump. It's kind of a no mince on the pillow at the Motel 6. The waitress is a bit tardy or inattentive at the Cracker Barrel. Or maybe you ended up with a neighbor's phone bill. He's got primetime relatives in Zanzibar and Timbuktu. Type of lumps. Martha was put out, but was she really put upon? Maybe a little. It was a bit inconvenient, but after all, what is a little housework? I'm not minimizing it because I know housework can be heavy. But at this time, it's time to balance priorities compared to sitting at the feet of the being and taught up close and personal by the very creator of the universe. Kind of got to get that one balanced out a little more. Perspective. So many things in life are a matter of perspective and being able to see things. And as we grow up, Matthew 5:48, become you therefore perfect or spiritually mature as your Father is in heaven. To me, that's one of the most powerful scriptures in the Bible. There Christ told us, one of the first things he preached, you can indeed become like my Father. And beyond that, I expect you to. And here's the program. Here's the plan. And he lays it out along with his disciples. Perspective. It's reality time, as Sig Wollman stated. Time to keep the mintless pillows of life, the small lumps of our sojourn in their proper place emotionally. It's good prep work for minor lump aid in the world tomorrow. And I'm sure we're going to have a few more during the feast. Regardless of Jim Stafford said, it's all these folks out here in 76, he said, that's not tourists. That's Osmonds going to work. Now, that was 20 years ago, and I understand the Osmonds aren't as active, but there were a lot of them, I guess. Anyway, so we get challenged a little bit by that. Okay, finally, got a few minutes left here. Let's turn back just one chapter, chapter 9, verse 51. Another lump of the oatmeal kind. And here we're going to see how our spiritual big brother handled it. This minor league lump. I'd like to read from an expanded paraphrase of this little episode of Christ's University of the Road called The Man Nobody Knows by Bruce Barton. Read a little bit from this chapter. It was very late in the afternoon. If you would like to learn the measure of a man, that is the time of day to watch him. We're all a half an inch taller in the morning than at night. And it's fairly easy to take the large view of things when the mind is rested and the nerves are calm. But the day is a steady drain of small annoyances, and the difference in the size of the men becomes hourly more apparent. The little man loses his temper and his grip. The big man takes a firmer hold. It was very late in the afternoon in Galilee. The dozen men who had walked all day over the dusty roads were hot and tired. And the sight of the village was very cheering as they looked down on it from on top of the little hill. Their leader, deciding that they'd gone far enough, sent two members of the party ahead to arrange for accommodations while he and the others sat down on the roadside to wait. After a bit, the messengers were seen returning, and even at a distance, it was apparent there was something unpleasant. Something unpleasant had occurred. Their cheeks were flushed, their voices angry. As they came nearer, they quickened their pace, each wanting to be the first to explode the bad news. Breathless, they told it. The people in the village had refused to receive them and had given them blunt notice to stay, to seek shelter somewhere else. The indignation of the messengers communicated itself to the others, who at first could hardly believe their ears. This backwards village refused to entertain their master? It was unthinkable. He was a famous public figure in that part of the world. He'd healed sick people, given freely to the poor. In the capital city, crowds had followed him enthusiastically, so that even his disciples had become men of importance. Looked up to, talked about. And now to have this country village deny them admittance as its guests. Lord, these people are insufferable. One of them cried, let us call down fire from heaven and consume them. The others joined in with enthusiasm. Fire from heaven, that was the idea. Make them smart for their boorishness. Show them they can't affront us with impunity. Come on, Lord, the fire. There are times when nothing a man can say is nearly so powerful as saying nothing. A business executive can understand that. To argue brings him down to the level of those with whom he argues. Silence convicts them of their folly. And they wish they had not spoken so quickly. They wonder what he thinks. The lips of Jesus tightened. His fine features showed the strain of the preceding weeks, and in his eyes were the foreshadowing of the more bitter weeks to come. He needed that night's rest. He said not a word. Quietly gathered up his garments and started on. His outraged companions following. It's easy to imagine his keen disappointment. He'd been working with him for 3 years. Would they never catch the true vision of what he was about? He had so little time, and they were constantly wasting it. They wanted him to gratify his personal resentment by burning up a village. Down the hot road, they trailed after him, awed by his silence, vaguely conscious that they'd failed again to measure up. And they went to another village, says the narrative. Nothing more. No debate, no bitterness, no futile conversation. In the mind of Jesus, the thing was too small to comment. In a world where so much must be done and done quickly, memory could not afford to be burdened with a petty slight. And they went to another village. A small lump. A very small lump. A powerful statement by the trainer of trainers and the mentor of mentors on how to handle the lumps of the throat and those in the oatmeal. There are going to be many of those kind in the millennium, just like today, I'm sure. Just ask Barnabas and Paul. Let's finish up with a little bit more SIG. Fulcham, learn to separate the inconvenient from the real problems. You will live longer. And it will not annoy people like me so much. Good night. In a gesture combining dismissal and blessing, he waved me off to bed. Seldom in my life have I been hit between the eyes so hard with truth. There in the late night darkness of Sierra Nevada, on Sierra Nevada Inn, Sig Woolman simultaneously kicked my butt and opened a window in my mind. For 30 years now, in times of stress and strain, when something has me backed against the wall, I'm ready to do something really stupid. With my anger, a sorrowful face appears in my mind and asks, Fulcham, problem or inconvenience? I think of this as the Woolman test of reality. Life is lumpy, and a lump in the oatmeal, and a lump in the throat, and a lump in the breast are not the same lump. One should learn the difference. God gives us the ultimate freedom. The Deuteronomy 30:19 freedom of choice. It is the freedom to meet the lumps of life on their own terms and to make choices that with the help of the Holy Spirit will help us and others grow into that Matthew 5:48 spiritually mature divine nature. And in the process become truly more godlike. The Feast of Tabernacles is spiritual showcase time. Mr. Armstrong used to say that. We're on stage. Ambassador time before the world. Now, it doesn't mean the other 355 or so are not important. They certainly are. But we're in spotlight right now. I think Sig Woolman's reality test can help us. We're going to have a few lumps, like I mentioned, over the next few days. Who knows, maybe some of you have already had some. Learning about and handling the lumps of life is just about job one for Christians, preparing to help our potential brothers and sisters. And most of those 7.4 billion, I like to think of them as all potential brothers and sisters. And the time these days portray with their lumps is right up there. After all, life is lumpy. Just ask Sig. And spiritual child rearing is messy. Just ask God. And how we respond makes all the difference in the world. Now, tomorrow, and for the rest of eternity. Good night, Sig.